Hello. It's quiet in here. Quiet. Is it quiet in here? Who knows? Someone in here is, oh, it's so quiet. Someone in here is like, there's a little person in there going, ah! That's how we are. But, you know, if we come together and are quiet together like this, this part, sometimes it'll quiet down. It'll meet everybody with some quietness. So, as you probably know, we're doing a session this weekend. So some of the people here have been, they've been sitting in here for a couple of days. And some people just come in. So everyone's got their own different energy. And the cool thing is all the people come from outside and they bring in their good outside energy. And people who've been sitting here, still sitting here, bring their still sitting here energy. And it's a good meeting. It's a good meeting. So, I've got this theme for the weekend of mind only in early Chan. When Busho asked me what I was going to talk about this weekend, and I told him, he laughed at me. Because maybe it sounds a little esoteric, I don't know. But to me, the teachings on mind only in early Chan are very vividly alive. Just in where we are now. So just so you know, the word Chan is the Chinese pronunciation of the word that we pronounce in English and Japanese is Zen. So Chan is the Chinese origin of Zen. And this idea of mind only is a pretty pervasive aspect of the origins of our Zen tradition. I can give you some quotations. So, arguably the most famous quotation from Bodhidharma, the reputed founder of Zen, is Zen is a mind-to-mind transmission. And then we have a second ancestor, Weka. We don't know that much about him. Then we get a third ancestor, Sangsan, and to him is attributed this wonderful text that people read over and over again called Trust Heart Mind. Or heart-mind inscription, or faith and mind. Beginning to think these guys think mind is interesting. And then the fourth and fifth ancestors are not that well known, and we get to sixth ancestor Hui Neng, who's like, I guess, what we'd have to call a major dude. Hui Neng's relationship to mind-only Buddhism is a little more complicated, but I will say probably the most famous koan associated with him is monks were debating outside the monastery. One says the wind moves, the other says the flag moves. Sixth ancestor Hui Neng says, not the wind, not the flag, mind moves. And we get to Zhao Zhu, one of the greatest masters of all time, asking Nan Kuan, what is the Tao? Nan Kuan said, ordinary mind is the Tao. Matsa, who began the line that eventually became Rinzai Zen, was asked, what is Buddha? He said, this very mind is Buddha. And Shirto, beloved Shirto, who wrote the Song of the Grass of Hermitage, is better known for his poem, The Harmony of Difference and Sameness, which begins, the mind of the great sage of India is intimately transmitted. So, wow, mind, mind, mind. It's kind of weird because usually I'm just sitting up here talking about body. Ha-ha! Surprise! What does mind mean in this case? What does mind mean? In short, mind in this case means the totality of experience. Now. So everything that is experienced now, this is what the word mind is being used for. So, the motion of the fan, oh, you guys maybe can't see that. There's visual mind. The feeling of your butt on a seat, mind. Whatever you're thinking, like, what is this guy talking about? Mind. whatever feeling is in your heart. Like, I thought we were going to talk about something a little more practical. Mind. So, nothing is left out. The point of mind-only teaching is nothing is excluded. Everything that is experienced, mind-only. So you might say, well, that's just wrong because the fan is actually like a physical object. And that's cool. That's an interesting way to look at it. Pretty popular way to look at it. But the point here isn't to deny that there's a physical fan. It's just saying we don't know what a physical fan is. What we actually know is we're experiencing something. So this teaching is about radically shedding all the ideas and preconceptions we have and go, I don't know what, but something's happening. Something's happening. To quote the sage and Nobel laureate Bob Dylan, something is happening here, and you don't know what it is. So, mind only emerges very closely in harmony with Yogacara, which some of you may know I find interesting. And Yogacara is a type of school of Buddhism. But they talk about mind only a lot, very closely related. And with mind only becomes, there's an idea closely related to it that becomes very important called the idea of thusness, sometimes called suchness, tattva or tatata, thusness. So thusness pretty much means the same thing as mind only. It's just everything within experience here, this whole deal. Whatever this is. This old thing? So this may not be apparent, but actually the point of mind only and thusness is it is a profound affirmation of your experience. So, I don't know if you've noticed this. How many people here have chanted the Heart Sutra before? All right. Well, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. This is not a profound affirmation of your experience. This is a set of language that's designed to cut through your preconceptions. But it ends up looking like what they're saying is your experience isn't there. That's not ultimately what's being said, but it sort of starts to feel that way. So I vividly remember when I was sitting in this zendo, and I'd been chanting the Heart Sutra. You know, I just started coming morning zazen. That's how I did it. I didn't know what I was thinking. It came to morning zazen. It's quiet. And then suddenly everyone's, rah, 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 rah. What? This is weird. Anyway. And then what they were chanting about, once I managed to get past the fact that they were making all this noise, was so strange. But I thought, there's something about this that works for me. But after I'd been doing that for a few times, I came here once, must have been on a Saturday, we used to chant the Harmony of Difference and Sameness, this one that begins, the mind of the great sage of India is intimately transmitted. And in that it says, eye and sight, ear and sounds, nose and smells, tongue and taste, thus, depending on these roots, the leaves spread forth. Affirmation of experience. So there's this response in Zen to say, yeah, something is happening here, but you don't know what it is. We're actually probably all think something is happening here. That's not hard. The don't know what it is part is the part that's a little startling. Because really, the degree to which we don't know what it is really astonishing. Or at least, the liberative power of realizing how much we don't know what it is astonishing. So, mind only is about an ungraspable non-duality of experience. It's not about like getting mind only, because you actually can't, because it's already here. And you can't get at anything in it, because there's nothing in it that's separate from it. So this is a little aggravating to our little part of our mind that thinks, all I got to do is figure out what's going to get me what I want out of this situation. But that part of us is already aggravated enough, isn't it? I don't know about you guys. That part of me that thinks, I'm just going to figure this out and then everything will be cool, just keeps getting aggravated over and over again. Very frustrating. So non-dual. Any duality is not ultimately true. The fundamental problematic non-duality presented by mind-only teachings is the duality between self and objects. That seems very, I'm assuming, for everyone in this room, it's likely that for everyone in this room that seems very vivid and real, that you exist as something separate from other things. Central to this teaching is that's not ultimately true. It's just a conception that happens. It's mind-only. No big deal. It's merely mind. Another nice translation of mind-only, Vijñaptimātra or Vijñānamātra or Cittamātra, that's merely mind. Relax. It's merely mind. So, I'll read you a koan. Miaozong is a wonderful teacher. I can't remember her epoch or her era. She wrote some really lovely poems. Oh, 12th century. It's written down here. In my mind. Yeah, wonderful poet and teacher. And there's various koans that feature Miaozong. They tend to be Miaozong unflinchingly confronting patriarchy. But that's not really the theme I'm going to talk about today, but you might notice it in the koan. But I'm going to, although that's very important and interesting, that's not what I'm going to talk about today. Master Jian Yan Yuan said, as a well-brought-up lady from a wealthy family, how can you be prepared for the business of a great master? Miaozong replied, does the Buddha Dharma distinguish between male and female forms? Yuan questioned her further. He said, what is the Buddha? This mind is the Buddha. What about you? Miaozong replied, I've heard of you for a long time. I'm disappointed to find that you still say that kind of thing. First question Miaozong asked, does the Buddha Dharma distinguish between male and female form? Let's talk about this duality. He doesn't even want to bother to talk about that duality. This is an interesting question. But my interest here is when he says, you want to question it further, he says, what is the Buddha? The mind is the Buddha. What about you? So the mind is a Buddha. This just sounds like all those other things I read or recited at the beginning of the thing. Eight different teachers basically saying the same thing. But here's the mistake. What is the Buddha? The mind is the Buddha. What about you? Where's the you? If mind is Buddha, where's the you outside of it? She's like, give me a break. Like, you've got the Buddha mind and I'm sitting over here outside of it? What kind of non-duality is that? Not. So, mind is Buddha is not about, like, somebody over here is sitting over here with the Buddha mind, and, like, maybe if you, you know, you can go get it from him, or he can withhold it from you. That's not what this is about. Mind is Buddha is about that just this totality of experience is complete. It's complete. So we don't like it. Because if it's complete, why does it suck for me right now? Maybe you're like, I'm having a great time. Feels pretty complete. But I'm pretty confident that within a few hours, few minutes, few days, everyone in this room will be like, yeah, this is the most crappy complete mind ever. This is like, I don't want this Buddha. So, wow, it's just life. So the thing is, we're thinking we can grab it. We can grab its completeness. Its completeness can be in some form that's satisfying to the way we want it to be. And I don't think it's like that. So, here's another koan. By the way, this book is really good. The Hidden Lamp. The Hidden Lamp. One of the bigger contributions to Western Buddhist literature, I think, in the last 10 years. Yes?
Last name of author, please.
Edited by Kaplow and Moon. Stories of 25 Centuries of Awakened Women. It's not a single author. It's 100 ancient koans, each one with a commentary by a different female teacher, contemporary female teacher. Anyway. Yes. Deshan Zhuanshan, man, there are people in China who are just, you know, pained when I try and say things like that. Anyway, Deshan Zhuanshan was a great scholar of the Diamond Sutra, but he was not a Chan practitioner. He was traveling south in search of the Dharma, carrying his commentaries on the Diamond Sutra with him. Diamond Sutra being like a big long heart sutra. How about that? You like that one? In the course of his travels, he came across an old woman on the roadside selling tea and rice cakes. For those of you who don't know about these stories, danger! Don't go in! Anyway. He asked her, "Who are you?" She responded, "I am an old woman selling rice cakes." When he asked... Wow. Okay, when he asked if he could buy some refreshments from her, she inquired, "Venerable priest, what are you carrying in your bag?" He said, "I am a scholar of the Diamond Sutra, and here I have all my notes and commentaries." This guy's kind of like me. Hearing this, the old woman said, "I have heard that, according to the Diamond Sutra, past mind is ungraspable, present mind is ungraspable, and future mind is ungraspable. So where is the mind that you wish to refresh with these rice cakes, O scholar? If you can answer this, you may buy a rice cake from me. If not, you'll have to go elsewhere for refreshment." Deshan was unable to reply. The old woman then directed him to a Chan master nearby. Deshan burned all his notes and commentaries the next day. And I'm sure it happened exactly like that. You could play around with this koan for... We could probably do like a Rohatsu Sesshin 7 talks. Who are you? That's a real question. What are you carrying in your bag? Hey, everybody, what are you carrying in your bag? But my interest here today is in this, her point from the Diamond Sutra, which she just happened to know. Past mind is ungraspable, present mind is ungraspable, and future mind is ungraspable. So this mind-only thing is not about sort of like, I'm going to figure it out. I'm going to get it. I'm going to get that Buddha mind. It's really about acknowledging that the totality of our experience right here is only full of things we can't actually get a hold of. They're certainly all impermanent, which makes them ungraspable. But at the bottom of our heart, they're ungraspable. As long as we're trying to figure out how to get something within this field of experience to stay put and satisfy us, we will be frustrated, which is a tendency that we will probably all carry for a good long time. And so we should be nice to each other. But the thing is, the position here is that the condition of non-duality, it's how it is. So it's not like you have to get non-duality. You're not going to grasp that. Finally, I figured out everything's non-dual. Now I got it. He said it's how it is. Things are already like that. All the things you think are separate are already just interbeing. Wow. It's like a big family that's not quite as messed up as most of ours. So it's already like this. So it's kind of, and if all these people tell us that realizing, just actually realizing the non-duality of things is so liberating and so freeing in terms of our emotional baggage and our churning minds, why is it so hard to just hang out with it, to let it be the way it is? So consciousness is conditioned to construct duality. It's one of the most fundamental conditions, you know, when we're very young, the mind just starts doing that. It's like, oh, I'm separate from these other things. You know, it's like I can actually choose to do something that will get me what I want. And bell hooks, the resplendent African-American feminist scholar once wrote, "When we face pain in relationships, our first response is often to sever bonds rather than to maintain commitment." And in a certain sense, she's talking about a specific thing in this context, but here she's sawing a deep truth. At the beginning of human experience, it's painful. And we go, I can't just live in this undivided whole. I've got to cut some things off. I've got to cut some things off, cut some things out, and figure out what I can manipulate. And that tendency is formulated very early in a human consciousness, and it just flowers, and it gets really big, and wow, we're so good at it. Wow. Of course, I'm not arguing that you should remain in the state of like a baby, because babies aren't all that helpful to other people. Well, they are. Aren't they? I got to hang out with a baby recently. It was helping me all day. Like, wow, I just want to be here. I want to be here. So I'm just wrong again. Anyway, you know, the idea here would not be to return to just being like a baby, but to access some of what a baby's consciousness does in a way that's integrated into a healthy, developed human form. So we do all kinds of things. Our strategies for distancing are incredibly complex. So the ones, you know, there's really unbelievably pervasive ones. So the tendency to feel separate from other things, that's like, you know, that the feeling that I'm here and you're there. That's like, wow. That takes a good while to let go of for most of us. And we may only get fleeting glimpses of its absence, although the fleeting glimpses can be very liberative. But, you know, there's gross and subtle levels of how we cut ourselves off. And if we want to move towards non-duality, we need to be dissolving them at multiple levels. So, you know, you may see that with people that you love, you do things actively that cut yourself off from them. You use sarcasm. You ignore. You belittle. You go hide. You ever see that thing where there's a bunch of people, everyone's like got a laptop screen in between them? Or you walk in a room, there are eight people, they're all looking at phones. What's going on? When we face pain in relationships, our first response is often to sever bonds rather than to maintain commitment. It doesn't have to be that painful. It's like, oh, it's a little uncomfortable. It's a little boring. It's a little boring. Well, what about being bored with the people you love? I've been doing it all weekend. That's not really true. But there have been some moments of boredom. Like, wow, look, my mind makes boredom. Of course it does. Can I be intimate with that? Can I move towards that? So you want to see this. You want to see how you're engaged in activities that actively distance you. Can you shed those? Can you try something else? So the weirdest idea that we have in... No, is it the weirdest? There's a lot of weird stuff. There's this odd idea floating around in our tradition of practicing non-dualism. Doing it. And of course, you can't really do it because you're not separate from it to do it. But actually, the problem is you can't not do it. There's nothing else you can do. The only kind of doing available to you is to do non-duality. But that leaves us kind of going, how am I going to do that? I'm not sure how that works. So we can evoke the flavor. We can begin to evoke the flavor of what it looks like to practice non-duality, to move into the flow. So, I have to admit that I enjoy the word love. I think it's a powerful word. I think it means a lot of different things to different people. And I am going to now, for the rest of this talk, use the word love as basically meaning practicing non-duality. So, in this way, it's kind of funny because sometimes people say love means attachment. And in this case, what I'm saying is love means exactly non-attachment. So, what does that mean? So, a lot of times when we love somebody, you're like, you love your child, and you're like, God, I hope they manage to get through this goddamn class without failing, you know, or whatever it is. We have a lot of attachments around the people we love, and that is very normal, and pretty much seems to be an unavoidable aspect of our experience. But it's also true for most people I know that really love someone that there are moments within that where there's a very different flavor of love, which is more like the practicing of the non-dual. So, this is hard to talk about, but I'll try. I want to talk about being around the kids in my family. When they get together, they're nuts. They're loud and they're hilarious and they're bizarre. And I'm like, what is even going on? And they're wrestling and they're making dirty jokes. And I'm like, I'm the old guy. You're not supposed to make the dirty jokes when the old guy's here. Anyway, so I'm resisting, but I'm trying to play. And then sometimes they just wear me down. They just exhaust me. And I just sit there and they're just doing what they're doing. And I'm just there. I don't have to figure out whether it's right or wrong how they're doing it. And I don't have to figure out even whether I like it or not. I'm just there with these people that I love. And it's just like, it's pretty good. On the other hand, those of us who have ever been adolescent, I don't know, maybe some of you guys managed to skip that. Or have been a parent to an adolescent, may be aware that this process is sometimes rather fraught. And, I can remember so much time when I was a kid or when my son was a teenager, and there was, I'd be like frustrated with him. You don't even want to know what I put my parents through. Not good. And they got frustrated with me. But there were also moments where I'd just be like, we're here. I don't have any ideas about what should be happening. And I will say that they were probably more likely to happen when things were just completely bonkers. I vividly remember, I won't go into the details, but I was in profound crisis as a teenager. And at one point, my parents were trying everything. They were very loving. And at one point, it was just like, I just wore them down. And I remember my mom was just like, I don't know what to do. She said, we're going out to dinner, and we're going to go out of town, because we don't. Well, I live in a small town. It's like you see everyone you know all the time, so we could drive 20 miles away and sit down in this restaurant, and I have no idea what we did. But I know that we were together. She didn't explain anything to me. She was just there. Bell Hooks on the subject of love also writes, the practice of love offers no place of safety. We risk loss, hurt, and pain. We risk being acted upon by forces outside of our control. So this probably rings true to you guys. It's kind of hard. It's awesome, of course. Wonderful things happen, but sometimes it's hard. So that's why there's that impulse to sever bonds. But, you know, the funny thing is, I read this. I can't remember the context that well. It says, we risk being acted upon by forces outside our control. Is there an alternative, my friends? We think, maybe if I distance myself, I'm going to be safe. Give me a break. Things change. Wow. So we can sit around and hold this whole thing at bay, try, or we can jump in. You're going to have to jump in again because you'll jump right back out. Ah, cold! Jump in again. Everyone's been sitting all weekend knows you jump in. Ah, get back out. How do you get back out? Just thinking a lot. Worrying. Judging yourself. Judging someone else. Jump back in. Jump back in. So mind-only's roots come from the enormous emphasis in Buddhist thought on the power of our cognitive habits to govern our experience. And I talked about this quite a bit yesterday, so I'm just going to skip it, but just putting a huge emphasis on, rather than focusing on apparently external objects, focusing on taking care of your mind itself and what you choose to do. Taking care of your mind itself and taking care of what you choose to do. So, although I'm talking about non-duality, which is like unconceptualized, so there's not a lot of room for figuring things out in completely unconceptualized awareness. But figuring things out is also good. Yeah, I'm pretty confident we'll all keep doing it. So whether it's good or not, we might as well talk about a good way to do it. But it is part of the deal. And I just stumbled across, interesting for the Zen nerds around here, reading some Dogen, and he's quoting Pali Canon text directly and extensively, for those of you who find this interesting. Anyway, he quotes a Pali Canon text called The Five Ways of Removing Anger, which some of you may remember because we did a practice period on it with Bonnie Verbon Kerr a few years ago. Anyway, I came upon a little passage that really struck me. It was talking about when you see someone and they're doing something that you think is no good. What happens? So the language they use, I'm going to kind of retranslate because the language is a little unnatural to me. So it says, if you see impurity and feel disgust, take care of the disgust. Or it actually says, you must shed the disgust. If you see impurity and feel disgust, shed the disgust. So let me rephrase this so it has a kind of a broader connotation. If you see something harmful and you feel afflictive emotion, that could be fear, anger, despair, shame, any of it. If you see something harmful and you feel that, take care of the feeling. Take care of the feeling first. So, and if this is not apparent, why this relates to mind only, normally, just to make this explicit, normally instead of taking care of the feeling, what we do is we go, that sucks, and we think about it for a long time, and then maybe we do something to try and manipulate it, right? Or maybe we just sit around and churn about it. Has anybody here been churning at great length about things that are vast and apparently outside their control? Okay, just checking. I thought I'd heard about that. So anyway, this moment is not light. I suspect that many people here were really felt some difficult emotions when the verdict in the trial about the killing of the Philando Castile came down on Friday. So Philando Castile was a young man who was shot and killed during a routine traffic stop. And many people in this community, including me, have really strong feelings about it. And we feel that the fact that that young man was killed has a lot to do with a massive system of systemic racism that's been going on in the United States for hundreds of years. And it's painful for people. So in this case, when I look at this, I see this external object, and I see harm. The language they use is impurity. I don't really value the language of impurity, but affliction. I see harm. Something harmful is happening. So non-dual, these Buddhist teachings aren't about, oh, it doesn't matter, it's just non-dual. That's not what this is about. So you see this, and then the invitation is first to come in here and see, ah, I'm experiencing an afflictive emotion. I should take care of this. This should be the basis of what I choose to do. From that basis, and how do I take care of it? There are a lot of ways to take care of how we feel. But pure presence to our own feeling should be the most, the go-to approach. Being with other people, talking about it, it's all good. But anyway, from that, that's where, if I'm just freaked out about it, I'm not that helpful to other people, I don't think. Mind-only teachings are based on the idea that whatever emotional energy gets put into the world is what is carried forward. So this is kind of contrary to the way we think. Normally you think, if I'm pissed at you, but I need you to stop doing this, if I can just get you to stop doing that right now, that's the good thing, right? So you're being mean to someone, I'll just be like, stop being mean! I know you're always really mean to people. Aaron is not mean to people. So, or at least I've never seen you be mean. But so you see someone, you said someone kind of, you go, hey, shut up! You can't say that! And you think, well, I got him. But he did shut up. Right? That's a very conventional, people treat their children this way. If I just shame my child or cow them, they will stop doing what they're doing. Right? Fundamental way human beings are conditioned. The law of karma on which mind-only teaching are based is that what got put into the system there is fear, control, anger, and shame. Short-term gains are based on these tiny little ideas of these little dualities within this moment that can be resolved. The non-dual is about everything is connected. So what we want to put into the system is something loving, kind, connected. So in this case, when I hear the news and I feel the pain of the loss of this person from the community in which I live, I can take care of that. I try to take care of that. And then it's important because my pain is really what I want to be able to do is hear the people who knew him, is to hear the people from the African-American community for whom this is a much deeper wound. I can't hear those people that well if I'm just waving my arms around going, God damn it! I need to take care of this so I can hear the cries of the world, the activity of Avalokiteshvara. And from that kind of intimacy, I can begin to hear other voices. And then finally, I can choose to act based on a sense of connection that we're in this together. Something based on the non-dual. So to wrap up here, I want to talk about Zazen. You guys ever tried it? It's pretty good. It's pretty good. Sometimes you might be like, this is not good. I don't know what this is, but it's just not good. And sometimes you're like, oh, it's very good. Trying to access a non-dual view of this. Can you have enough trust that just sitting still is enough? That's not, but you're not going to do it right and you can't do it wrong. When we practice Zazen, we do an activity that fundamentally cultivates or enacts the non-dual. The duality is created by mental constructions which divide things up, and we're actively not dividing. So we're just sitting here. I guess that's divisive because we're sitting instead of standing. But let's just let that go for a minute. We just sit. We're not trying to make something happen. You're not trying to make yourself be someone else. You're not trying, you don't do Zazen to try and be a better person. You're complete. You're complete. Just, I could say let it happen, but you don't have to let it happen because it's already happening. You don't have to make it happen because it's already happening. Mother Teresa once said, if you judge people, you don't have time to love them. If you judge people, you don't have time to love them. So what our mind is conditioned to do is judge the world. You're over there, I'm over here. You're pretty good. I'm not sure. How am I doing? Whatever. However we're doing it. It's too hot. Yesterday I was like, it's too hot. Sitting here in all my robes. I'm like, why? Just let it come in. Let it come in. We judge people, you know, sometimes we judge people like, there may be a couple people you've really got out there way at arm's reach. But maybe even the people you love, you get annoyed and you just push them away. Judging. Zazen is fundamentally activity of non-judging. And I do this, I cultivate my capacity to do this for the liberation of all beings, and that's what I invite you to do for everyone. And I will end with a quotation from Cornel West, who, whenever I hear, well, I'll just say, he said, never forget that justice is what love looks like in public. So this love that we are cultivating, it goes on. It goes on. Let it go on. Let it go on. Never forget that justice is what love looks like in public. Thank you. Well, I think we could have words for a few more minutes. Is that hopefully that's okay with all the people in session? So, if people want to say things now, you may. Yes.
Will you tell my professors that my cheat sheets are part of my mind?
So an important part of this tradition is skillful means. So the question I have to ask myself is, will that benefit all beings? Or will that be a short-term gain for me and you?
Question?
Yeah.
Other examples, examples in your very much teachings, history and Buddhism, of militarily effective Buddhist warriors.
I think so. I think there's lots. I haven't really studied them, but certainly in Japan, like there were monastic armies. I know in Japan, and I think there certainly. I mean, just in this century, there was a clear relationship between Buddhism and the Japanese imperialism. Also, in many other countries, there have been connections. And it's going on. So this is not. This doesn't. We don't get to jump out of our humanity with this. It's a practice.
And just to be fully clear, I bring that up because of news of this officer and many other officers across the country going to warrior training to have a warrior mindset in their policing.
Mm.
That basically means when in doubt, shoot first and take care of yourself.
Mm. Yeah. Well, the word, some people really find the word warrior to be somehow evocative of, you know, there are a lot of people like, I'm a warrior for peace. So that can be very moving to people. It's not a language that I tend to employ.
Look up Zen sword fighting. It's an ancient principle. It goes horseback with the samurai. And one of its principles is that your opponent's sword is also mined. It's a fascinating subject, and it goes pretty far.
Ryan Victoria also wrote a definitive discussion of the interplay between Zen and the government of Japan between 1876 and 1945. And it's an extremely fascinating book.
I'm going through a drive-thru and they ask me, where is your mind? I'm going to say, it's not my mind that's being refreshed here, it's my body.
Yeah. Well, just to be clear, the body is something we only experience as experience. Mm-hmm. So in this case, under this definition, it's mind.
Mm-hmm.
Which doesn't deny its bodiness. It affirms it much more than we usually do, I think. Anyway, but yes, refresh that body.
Will we have an active membership table today?
I don't think so. Usually during Sesshin, the idea is everyone flows on out of here so we can return to silence.
Guess I could give a membership form, too.
We have a winner. Thank you. Thank you very much. Did I see someone else's hand over here? Yeah.
Could you speak a little bit to, can we actually help others? Or I have this passage of Pema Chodron that she feels that, and I'm probably misquoting her, that helping the universe is just individual people working on their mind.
That's a very mind-only viewpoint. In a conventional sense, it's like, if everyone comes home in my house and I make dinner, I think everyone feels like I have helped them. And that's cool. It's nice. We all feel good. But there's a problem with the idea of helping people, which is if you're helping them, then it's very easy for you to think that you're superior to them and they need help. And then you get all these icky dynamics. So that's one of the reasons. So we're going to have a lot of conventional understandings that we help people, and that's cool. That will be encouraging. You probably don't want to stop, you know, when your baby is crying. But I can't help you. Not cool, right? So, but this teaching she's talking about and the teaching I'm talking about is What is most important is the quality of your intention as you do it. That's actually, so we see, we think there are all these discrete elements. I'll make my baby stop crying. But it's the quality of how we do it that ultimately is what's permeating the totality of the universe. And I think that seems... Oh, you want to say something?
I just want to share a quote from an Aborigines woman. A group of missionaries came to help her and her tribe, Aborigines woman in the outback of Australia. And she was one of the elders, and she met them, these missionaries, and she said, "If you're here to help us, don't waste your time. But if you're here because you know that your well-being relies on our well-being, then let's get to work."
Could you guys hear that? No. Well, I can paraphrase. I think so. This is a story about an Aborigine woman in Australia. Some people came, and they're like, "We're going to help you guys." And she said, "If you're here to help me, don't bother. If you're here because you realize that our well-being are interdependent, let's get to work." I do that all right? So, yeah, non-dual. Okay, well, how wonderful to get to have some time together. Great people, committed to doing their best. What more do you want? Thank you.